really big and really hard things have come along in my life, things that I've struggled with at the depth of my soul. And early in life, when I didn't have the truth to look at, I floundered. I couldn't find God and I couldn't see. But as I've put on the armor of God, that is the truth of who He is, and really understood it, I have been able to stand firm in my understanding and my belief in the goodness of God.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Jack, as has happened many times in our talking together, last week we were going to get into the passage on spiritual warfare. It's in Ephesians chapter 6, starting at verse 10, and I believe, Jack, you read through the whole passage.
Yes.
And then I don't think we hardly even touched it.
Barely.
Shame on us.
Yeah.
But we did get to some interesting kind of previews of this passage. So real briefly, before we actually get into the passage today, would you summarize what we said last time?
Okay.
And the question is, so what is spiritual warfare?
Spiritual warfare is the battle of our life, and that is the battle to believe the truth of the gospel and not allow ourselves to be deceived or seduced away from believing it. We didn't talk about this last week, but this might be a good way to review it. If we go to 1 John, for example, in chapter 5, he says, "For whatever is born of God overcomes the world, and this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith. Who is the one who overcomes the world but he who believes that Jesus is the Son of God?" There John is saying, I think, the same thing that Paul is trying to say in this passage on spiritual warfare, that the real essence of my life here and now is I'm in a fight, I'm in a battle. There are forces arrayed against me that would want to lie to me and deceive me and thereby lead me away from that truth that will qualify me for the kingdom of God. And the fight I'm in is to stay my ground, not be driven off my ground, to keep believing, to keep the faith, to persist in living my whole life and having all of my attitudes informed by the fact that what the gospel promises is true and make that a priority. If I do that, I have, John says, overcome the world, because the world is all the people around me and the culture that they have created. And the culture that non-believing people have created is a culture that's based on values that are about being self-serving and self-protective and proud and haters of God and so on. That there's a whole culture based on that. And they tell sweet lies and they have a whole mythology built up that I'm surrounded by. And I need to resist all of that. I need to not buy into it, not believe it, in order to remain, to show myself, to demonstrate that I'm a child of God. And if I can resist all those lies and all the myths of the world, then I have overcome the world. I have believed the gospel, the truth instead, and I demonstrate that I am a born again child of God by doing that. That's essentially what we were talking about. That's the warfare that we're in. In contrast to a kind of popular view in Christian culture about spiritual warfare, which is my goal, my agenda is to have an effective ministry, make an impact on my culture politically and socially, keeping myself safe from harm, from poverty, from suffering, and the forces arrayed against me are arrayed against me to make my life miserable in one way or another. And what the Bible is promising me is that if I will just figure out the right way to get God to go to work on my side, I can beat back those forces that would make my life miserable and have a successful, happy life instead. That's a wrong, false view of spiritual warfare, I'd argue.
So the right view of spiritual warfare is that I stand firm, as Paul puts it here in Ephesians, by doing what's right, by pursuing what's good, by not living my life in a self-protected way, by challenging the selfishness and the pride in my life, by working toward being a humble, a compassionate, a forgiving, a caring person.
Yeah, exactly.
By not being a defensive person that just wants to justify my wrong, by being a person that's willing to see my wrong, by a person that's willing to be in relationship in a way that's responsible and caring. That's what he means by standing firm, because that's so different than the world and what they say is valuable. And what the world says is valuable is, you're not your brother's keeper. You take care of yourself first and foremost and always. If you're selfish, that's okay. Humility just gets you tramped on. Don't care about somebody else, care about yourself. Or if you do care about them, always keep yourself in mind. It's really the person that never, ever should have to compromise. Never, ever should have to give in. Never, ever should be the one that shows your underside. Be defensive. Be protected. And on and on and on.
Right, right.
So I'm just trying to kind of make it real.
Mm-hmm.
Those are very different goals.
Right.
And sometimes our Christian culture goes more toward the worldly goal that says keep yourself okay. It's kind of doesn't. It's a godless theology that we have, because it's all up to us to get our lives working. Because sometimes it seems to me with a spiritual life, we can have a great deal of suffering that goes on, and that doesn't have to do with God not working in our lives. It could have a lot to do with God working in our lives in and through the suffering.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And I want to say one thing spiritual warfare also is not. It's what I always thought it was. It was that things are going to kind of mysteriously come out of nowhere, and they're going to attack me, and Satan is going to hurt me. So what I need to do is make sure I read my Bible, make sure I have prayer times, make sure I get up in the morning and have devotions, make sure I do all the spiritual disciplines that I can think of, maybe fast, in order to keep Satan from destroying my life.
Right. Yeah. A very kind of, I would consider, superstitious view of spiritual warfare. And that I use all of these various charms to keep the forces of evil at bay and keep them away from me so they won't harm me. Exactly. I don't think that's how Paul's thinking about this at all.
So let's go into it and look at it verse by verse and see if we can really pull out what it's saying. So the first verse, again, we're in Ephesians 6:10. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might.
Okay, the question, of course, is strong in what sense? And what I'm arguing is that what will make the most sense in this passage is strong in faith, essentially, strong in my conviction and in my commitment to the truth as truth. I'm not going to waver from the truth. I'm going to embrace it with all of my might and not let go of it. So I'm strong in my attachment to the gospel, essentially.
And Jack, if I look up to the verses right above that, it's talking about children obeying your parents, and fathers, don't provoke your children, and slaves, be obedient, not by way of eye service, render service as to the Lord, not to men, and masters do the same. It's talking about good actions,
mm-hmm.
standing perhaps in trying to do what's right, all of you guys, he's saying.
Right.
And then it seems like finally, don't just be strong in all that stuff, but in the same way, be strong in the Lord.
Right.
Be obedient. Do what's right.
Right. That's right.
And Jack, what does it mean, and in the strength of his might? There was always kind of this mysterious thing for me when I learned this, that I should kind of have strength in his might, kind of like I should conjure that up and feel something big and strong inside of me. And kind of like if right before you go into battle, you kind of have this adrenaline rush and then you can move. Is that what it means? I know it doesn't mean that.
Right. Well, I think the idea is that he's, you know, he could just say be strong, but he says be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. The point that he's making is that this is a supernatural reality. When anybody keeps the faith, they do so not because they are strong, committed, devoted. It's not that there's something about me that is particularly noteworthy and virtuous. I am what I am by the grace of God. I am a believer by the grace of God. I am one who overcomes, to use John's language in 1 John. I'm one who overcomes the world as a miracle of God's work within me. And I think it's just Paul's way of underlining the fact that you don't have the resources within yourself to kind of conjure up and pull on to be a good believer, to be a strong believer. Whatever strength there will be in the Lord. That is, will be in the strength of his might. It's God who's at work in you to produce this commitment to the truth of the gospel. So be strong. This is what's confusing to us so much, is that we take a commandment like that and we think that what Paul is saying is you've got these infinite resources available to you, but those resources are of no profit to you unless you let them somehow be of profit to you. You have to unleash that power. You have to open yourself to being accessible to that power so that that power can transform you. So it's like it's a commandment to me to let the power of God work in me. And I think that's the wrong way to think about a commandment like this. There are two things that are true at the same time. On the one hand, this is the work of God in me, and it's irresistible. It's just going to happen. I am going to be strong. If God has decided I'm going to be a child of God, I'm going to be a believer, then the strength is going to be there from the Lord to hang in there. Well, the question is, okay, if that's true, then why are you commanding me to be strong? Well, because Paul recognizes that the way that the power and strength of God to overcome the world manifests itself in my life is through decisive commitments that I make. It doesn't come upon me and I become a believer in spite of myself. I don't become a believer in spite of my choices. I become a believer in and through the choices I make. I choose to bow to the truth. I choose to be open to it and not resist it, not be hostile to it, not be closed off to it. But it's a choice that I make. And so Paul phrases it in the form of a commandment because he recognizes there is something I need to do. I need to not be hard-hearted. I need to not be resistant. I need to not be hostile to the truth, to faith. And so be strong in the Lord is a way of commanding me to that kind of openness. But at the same time, he's wording it in a way that shows that he's cognizant of the fact that it really takes a strength of heart, a strength of character to do that, and that strength does not come from us, it comes from God. He probably puts it best in Philippians when he says, "Work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for God is at work in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure." There you see the tension just laid out there
both
really
of them together
clearly
at the same
and explicitly.
Time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what he's, in a figurative kind of way, doing in a verse like this. Be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Is there something I need to command you to do and exhort you to do? Yes. You need to have the strength of character to be open to the truth. And that's something you have to do. How are you going to have the resources to do that? Well, only in the Lord, only in the strength of his might.
Okay, so the next verse. Put on the full armor of God, that you may be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. So the questions would be, what's a full armor of God? What's standing firm? And what are the schemes of the devil?
Okay. Well, standing firm, we've talked about it. He starts here with verse 11 with a kind of military metaphor. And he's envisioned us as having gained some ground in the battle. Let's say we've gained the top of a hill or something on the battlefield. The enemy is going to want to drive us back down the hill. They don't want us to be able to keep our position on the hill. Our object is to stand our ground so that we have the hilltop and not the enemy. In order to do that, we need to be fully armed, prepared, ready to fend off the attack of the enemy, who is seen to be the devil. So it's this metaphor about standing firm, standing your ground, and not retreating. So we've come to the gospel, we've seen that it makes sense, we've seen that it's intellectually compelling, we've seen that it's personally and existentially valuable and significant, but are we going to stay there? Are we going to continue to view it that way? Or is the devil going to be able to attack our faith and make us retreat from us, make us back off from it and decide, well, it's not that valuable, it's not that significant, in fact, maybe it's not even true. I mean, we see that in life all the time. People who come to faith, they begin down the road of faith, they're intrigued by it, they find it interesting, they find it compelling, but then things come along in their life and after a while they drift away or are driven away. And, you know, there's months or years later, they're not believing any longer. Well, they have not stood firm. They have not stood their ground. They've been driven back down the hill by the enemy. He talks about the schemes of the devil, or I think it could be translated ploys, the stratagems of the devil. The devil has all kinds of different lies that he tells, different ways that he tries to undermine our confidence in the truth of the gospel. And any one of them might hit, you know, any one of them might hit the target.
Our confidence in the truth, or maybe our interest in it.
Our interest, yeah. Yeah.
Maybe it's just those things.
Mm-hmm.
That those would be the schemes he would tell us that, hey, maybe this is not really the way to go. Maybe there's other stuff that's really much more interesting than this.
Mm-hmm.
And, Jack, I used to think, you know, what does it mean, the schemes of the devil? Is that I'm just going to kind of hear this voice, this bad voice, or am I going to, you know, what exactly does that mean? And it was really hard for me to take it out of kind of that mysterious realm again and just put it into, it could be that I'm looking at a man that's really handsome and that's really attractive to me in many ways, and I could be very interested in leaving my husband for that man.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be, quote, a scheme of the devil.
Absolutely.
Helping, making us interested, or us being interested in going in a direction that's wrong.
Right. Any way that lies get told to us by any medium, I think Paul would call them the schemes of the devil.
But it isn't necessarily from any medium out there. My example is just from inside. I was losing interest. I saw somebody else that was interesting to me. I didn't even need anybody else to provoke me on that one. I just want to go toward it.
Yeah. I'd have to think about this. I mean, I'm inclined to say that what he has in mind by the schemes of the devil are the ways, though, that the environment around me provides an impetus or a suggestion to the sin that is within me and is trying to strike me at points in which I'm vulnerable. I mean, your point is that I am vulnerable inside, and
yes,
that's true. I mean, it's my own vulnerability that is being attacked. But there's so many ways in which the world and my environment and my culture plays on my vulnerabilities. I mean, you look at the advertising industry. The advertising industry, clearly the devil is the CEO of the whole advertising industry. I mean, what works is to appeal to all the places where we are vulnerable. So we use sex appeal, sexuality in advertising. We play on people's insecurities. We appeal to them for their desire to be popular in all kinds of different ways. And all they're trying to do is sell products. But there's an even more insidious message behind all of that, and that is this underlying assumption, this big underlying lie that undergirds all of that, and that is happiness is to be found in all of these ways or through one of these means, through pleasure, through popularity, through
stuff,
exactly. And you know, we're constantly barraged by this whole mindset, this whole attitude toward human existence that comes in beautiful, aesthetically appealing photographs and images and concepts, all of which are very appealing to us. If we don't critique them, if we don't recognize, but that's a lie, that's a fiction, that's a fantasy, the truth is happiness lies elsewhere, after a while I get worn down and I just capitulate to that whole mindset that everybody in the world around me buys into, and I just give up and I say, I'm going to buy into that too. I want what they want. I want my life to be about what their life is all about. Because look how beautiful it is, or how beautiful it appears. All that's a part of the stratagem of the devil to undermine our grasp of what's really real and really true. It can come in books, movies are the other area where the devil is working big time. There's so many lies get told to us through movies. Beautifully done, beautifully told tales, beautiful myths.
Well, you and I were talking about Cider House Rules. It's a movie that I saw recently that is an incredible lie. It is probably the most frightening movie I've ever seen in my whole life, and it was beautifully done. The actors did a grand job. The woman that played the main role, I can't remember her name, was very, very lovely. The countryside was just intoxicating. It was so pretty. There was this older man who was a doctor who did a whole lot of really good things, and yet underneath there was so much evil lurking in him, and he was just such a nice guy that it was hard to tell the difference, and it was so alluring. And I think that's really what we're talking about here.
Right.
That movie was such a picture of the schemes of the devil.
Exactly.
Beautifully presented lies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what's the whole armor of God, Jack?
Well, now we have a decision to make about this text, and I'm still in the process of studying the book of Ephesians, so I don't have any final definitive conclusion about this, but my inclination at this point is to see the full armor of God as just being one image, not a sophisticated analysis of the psychology of faith. He's going to go on to talk about gird your loins with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. And you'll get Bible teachers who will take each element of the armor and have it represent some part of the psychology of spiritual warfare or psychology of belief or whatever. I mean, but they have each piece represent some truth, some principle, some reality.
Separately.
I'm inclined to think that's not what Paul is doing here, that he doesn't have some kind of real sophisticated allegory happening. But it's just a simple metaphor that we have to be prepared for the attacks of the evil one, the lies and myths of the evil one. And how do you prepare yourself for it? You armor yourself. You put on your armor. And putting on armor, if you go back to the prophets, there are a number of times where you can see whenever God determines that he's going to do something in history, it will use the metaphor of he clothed himself in justice, or he clothed himself in judgment, or he put on this, or he put on that. It seems to be a long-standing metaphor for the purpose of your heart, your intent, your goal, your determination, something you've determined to do. So by putting on the full armor of God and then going on to say, put on this, put on this, put on this, it seems to be a metaphor for the kind of resolve, a resolution of your will, that this is what you want your life to be all about. This is how you are identifying yourself. In God's case, he was coming in judgment. He was identifying himself as a God of judgment. Now, what are we going to make our identity? Are we going to make it righteousness, truth, the gospel? Are we going to make that our identity? Well, then how do you portray that? By suggesting that you need to clothe yourself, or in this case, armor yourself with that. You need to put it on. I suppose our metaphor would be when we talk about taking something on is a similar kind of metaphor. Especially we talk about a cause. Are you going to take on that cause? Are you going to make that a part of your life, a part of your identity, a part of your being, or not? And I think what Paul is saying is the only way we can fend off the attack of the evil one and resist his lies and not succumb to him is if we really take on the gospel. We really make it the thing that defines my existence and defines my identity.
So I might be able to read that then, put on the whole truth of God, that you may be able to stand firm in what is good, so that when the lies that the Satan puts out that really look beautiful come along, you'll be prepared.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's exactly what he's saying.
Okay, I think we're going to need to come back, and certainly the text comes back to the full armor of God starting in 13 again. So can we go into it more then?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So are we ready for verse 12?
Yeah.
For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places.
Okay. Yeah, this is crucial to understand. This really, I think, puts together everything he's saying in this section. It would be easy to, in the day where we read novels by Frank Peretti, I've never read any of them, but I've heard people talk about them, where the image we have is this kind of superstitious view of there are all these demons out there that are lurking behind every person, every institution, cultures, and everything. And so the only way I can have an impact socially and politically, for example, or evangelistically, the only way I can have an impact is to fight off the evil demons behind things, strip them of their power by employing devices that God has given me, like prayer or fasting or whatever. I strip the forces of evil of their power, and then we can go in and evangelize or
help people. I would even say,
people, yeah.
In the psychological realm, that's also true, because what I hear from people that come in who have been involved with a different understanding of spiritual warfare than this is sometimes they will say they went to their pastor or some church worker, and that person identified them as having a spirit of alcoholism, for example, or a spirit of lust. And what they do is they do a procedure that helps get rid of this spirit that's in them that's causing the problem. And their belief is if they can just get rid of this, for example, spirit of alcoholism or spirit of lust, then this person will be okay. And they come into me often and say, I went through this process, and so it's no longer a problem, and yet they come in drunk.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a real double bind for them. But it's very big, I think, in the church in many realms.
Yeah, and I don't want to step on toes, but I have to say I think it's just superstition, pure and simple. It's not what the Bible is saying. It's a very fanciful folk religion sort of belief that, you know, we just need to cast out the demons and cast out the spirits and use some mumbo jumbo to handle this problem and this problem. And we don't have to do the real work of my own repentance, of my own coming to embrace the truth and believe the truth and obey my God. What Paul is saying is exactly the opposite of what is so popular in that superstitious sense. Let me try to capture what he's saying this way. Let's say that my marriage, I'm having difficulty in my marriage and I'm about to lose my marriage. I'm on the verge of a divorce because of the conflict between my wife and I. It's very likely, very possible, that I'm going to tend to focus on, you know, particularly if I really want this marriage, I really want to save this marriage is valuable to me, this relationship is valuable to me, it's very likely that I'm going to see the real problem in my life being the attitude of my wife, the relationship with my wife, the break, the alienation between me and my wife. I'm going to see that as the problem of my life right now. And so if I define the battle or the struggle that I'm having, I'm going to say the struggle is I can't somehow reach any reconciliation with my wife. I can't seem to be reconciled to her. That's my struggle. I think what Paul is trying to say in this verse is, no, that's not your struggle. Maybe you can be reconciled to your wife, maybe you can't be reconciled to your wife, but the most important, the most significant struggle of your life is, what are you going to do with the truth in the midst of this conflict that you're having, in the midst of this interpersonal alienation and the problems, emotional, psychological, personal problems that results in for you in your life? What are you going to do with the truth? because what I'm going to be tempted to do is to do everything I can to control the heart and mind of my wife. I'm going to try to win her. I'm going to want to win her. I'm going to want to manipulate her into loving me, into accepting me, into being reconciled to me again. And that is going to be such a pull on me that I might even be willing to compromise righteousness in order to do that. I might even be willing to forsake my God in order to hold on to my relationship with my wife. We could get more specific in the details, but, you know, for example, what if I have a wife who won't be reconciled with me unless I'm willing to basically be evil? She's not interested in goodness. She's not interested in truth. She's not interested in God. And my relationship with God has got in the way of our relationship. And she'd be interested in a relationship with me if I would give up on this God stuff. If I wouldn't keep interjecting truth and righteousness into the mix, then she'd be interested in me. But she's weary of me and everything I stand for with this God junk that I brought into the relationship. Well, it would be a tremendous temptation. If this is a valuable relationship to me, it would be tremendously tempting to say, okay, I'll get rid of this God junk. And I could easily rationalize it. I'm saving my marriage. I mean, God wouldn't want me to lose my marriage. God hates divorce. There's all kinds of ways I could rationalize it. But what Paul is saying is you miss the whole point then. Because the battle of your life, the struggle of your life that ultimately counts is not can you save your marriage. The ultimate struggle is can you save yourself? Can you save your soul? Can you save your faith? Can you stand your ground?
And sometimes, like in that situation, it might mean that your marriage does not go forward.
Exactly.
It isn't that you're pursuing divorce.
No.
What you're doing is pursuing righteousness, and your wife might leave you.
Right.
And I think you're right. We get really confused about what the real issue is. We become distracted by what's out there rather than paying attention to how am I related to God? Am I rightly related or not?
Exactly. And so that's, I think, his point here. You have to understand what your real struggle is in life. Your real struggle in life, the victory you have to win, is the fight over whether or not you're going to believe. It's the struggle of faith. It's to overcome to the point of belief. All this other stuff is relatively minor by comparison. So the example you gave of someone coming in has a problem with alcohol, they may very well see the only struggle in their life as getting rid of their problem with alcohol. I think what the Bible is saying is, well, that may be a problem, but you got a bigger problem than that. And maybe you don't even ever win the battle with alcohol, but don't focus on that. Focus on this other problem over here, which is far more important and far more significant and has far more dire consequences if you lose it.
Or, Jack, the way I might deal with it, though, is help them to focus on their issue with alcoholism in order to help uncover.
See the other problem.
What's really going on.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
I think that could be misleading. People could say, okay, I don't even think about that. I'll just, you know, walk away from even having to deal with that. Great, I'm off the hook. And I don't think that's it at all.
No.
I can use that as the pathway into the soul of that person.
Right.
You know, what is generating the need for drinking? And indeed, they may never stop drinking. But I think, and this is going to be kind of radical, it's better to keep drinking than to stop drinking and think that all is well with my heart.
Exactly.
And because I've done that, I've become a spiritual person because I've stopped drinking, and that becomes kind of the feather in my cap. I might not have grown at all in terms of understanding my need for repentance, how I've hurt people through that, how I've run away from God through my alcoholism, how I've succumbed to lie after lie. All I've done is I've dried up.
Right. That's exactly, I think, what Paul is trying to capture in this verse, is to see the difference between fighting all these other minor skirmishes of our life when we are leaving ourselves completely unprotected and unprepared for the real battle that counts. And that is, are you or are you not going to believe the truth about who you are in relationship to God and how one's life should be lived in the light of that? Are you prepared for that or not? Because our real battle is not against the people that we think are the problems of our life. That's what he means by not against flesh and blood. they're against forces of evil that are arrayed against us for one and only one purpose, to get us to believe lies rather than the truth.
Jack, I remember years and years ago, maybe 17 years ago, I was starting a new practice down in San Diego, and I was calling pastors and kind of telling them I was new in town and I was wanting to get together with them, that I was a Christian. And I remember one pastor saying to me, "Okay, so you're a Christian. What makes your counseling any different than any others?" And I was taken aback. I didn't know how to answer it well. But this is really the answer, and it's the challenge of the Christian therapist. It's, and am I going to look at the outside circumstances and try to change behavior? Which is exactly what the counseling profession is going toward. What you do, there's managed health. What you do is you take 5 sessions with somebody and you change their behavior. That's really scary to me, because I can change somebody's behavior, but what I'm left with is a heart that still is rotting inside. And so it takes a real different perspective than what the world is going toward to keep in my mind. I'm not heading toward just having them change behavior. So what if they do that? Maybe that's even hurting them worse. But I'm going to go to the heart of the matter. I'm going to use the circumstances in their life to help me help them see. I, for example, have a lot of people that come to me with a problem with pornography. They identify that as the problem in their life, and they just want to stop it. I address that, and they think that where we're going to end up is just them feeling off the hook and less guilty because they're not doing that anymore. And where we end up is them doing the whole work of repentance. And what is that work? The work is identifying that I'm a person who's in need of God. I'm a person who's a sinner. I'm a person through my sin who is hurting myself, who is being blind to God and is hurting other people. That can be a whole renaissance in the heart of somebody and can give them so much more in terms of a capability to love each other, to love God, and to love themselves than just stopping a behavior. You with me?
Yeah. So you're really basically an evangelist.
I am an evangelist.
Yeah.
I call myself an evangelist sometimes. Although it's a very creative way to go in that direction.
In a very personal way.
Very personal. And I don't think the person feels, quote, evangelized at all. They feel loved.
Right.
They are being loved. And yet what I see over and over again is people coming to an understanding of who God is, understanding their own sinfulness, and coming to repentance. It is an incredibly beautiful thing to watch God do. Mm-hmm. And I just get so amazed when people don't like counseling, because on one hand, I see just a change of behavior that most counseling does is, I think, very hurtful at best. And yet, from this perspective, I am so alongside the church. I am an evangelist just as the church is an evangelistic tool in God's hands. Mm-hmm. I'm a lover of people just as the church is a lover of people. I teach people forgiveness. I teach people repentance. People through this understand confession. They understand the cross. And many times, these are people who thought they were believers, and this it just deepened their faith in ways they can hardly believe. And other people who aren't believers at all come to believe.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suspect that what was behind, I mean, it wasn't really until I started interacting with you that I came to see that there were counselors who really could have integrated their faith with their counseling, because all too often what I saw were people who were Christians, kind of incidentally, but their counseling was completely informed by the profession, that is, by all the attitudes and worldview and perspectives and techniques of the of that profession itself, secularly trained, and they were kind of compartmentalized. There wasn't really any integration between the two, at least it looked that way. And I think that's often the perspective that a lot of pastors who seem to and appear to oppose counseling, that's probably where they're coming from. They have seen Christian counselors who identify themselves as Christian counselors who have a very secular approach to counseling that they have somehow baptized in some kind of superficial way, and they're put off by that. I mean, that's probably where that pastor's question was coming from. Is yours you're a Christian, does that make you any different? Because they've seen a lot of cases where it doesn't really make them substantially different. But one of the things that I come to see in working with you is that you really could see your counseling role. You could really do evangelism in the context of a counseling exercise.
And I can't
imagine
a place.
And that makes a lot of sense to me.
I can't imagine a place that's even more effective than that.
Sure, absolutely.
Maybe equally as effective other places. But evangelism is incredibly effective because it's so personal.
Right.
It's
right.
So to the core of that individual person's heart. And I don't know, it's just a wonderful tool that God has in our community, or has in our world to use if it's used appropriately. But, I think on the other hand, counseling which is done that's according to a misunderstanding of this Ephesians is doing the same thing that secular counseling is doing. Secular counseling that says what we've got to do is just get rid of the behavior, and we do it through these cognitive tools, is really no different than the church community that says, I've got to get rid of the spirit of selfishness. What you do is you just put oil on your forehead, or I don't know the process that they might go through, and pray it out. Because the person hasn't become any wiser. They haven't come to see their need for forgiveness. They haven't come to see how they're hurtful to other people. They haven't seen the disintegration of their soul or the wall between themselves and God. All of those things are what's so important. They haven't done the difficult work. The difficult work is the work that leads me to repentance.
Right.
So have we taken care of this? The world forces of darkness, the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places, these are just descriptors of what?
Of, I think, real beings created by God who are forces of evil that have it as their intent, for some malicious reasons that I don't understand, to keep us from becoming children of God and enter into the kingdom of God. Their only goal is to keep us from belief.
And that, we've already gone through it some, but that can be through the media, that can be through
friends and neighbors that talk to me. I mean, remember, a classic example is Jesus tells his disciples that he's headed toward the cross, and Peter says, oh, no, you don't want to do that, Jesus. And Jesus' response is, get behind me, Satan, to Peter. That is, he recognizes that's the idea of Satan being communicated by Peter there.
Because Peter is not understanding what God is after.
Right.
And he's trying to misdirect Jesus from a direction that he really needs to go in. As difficult as it is, he needs to be going in that direction.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what we find, is that all kinds of voices around us, some very personal, friends, neighbors, some broadcast through the media, are voices telling us, don't go that direction, go this direction.
And it isn't out there in funny voices or through ghosts that come out of my closet. It's through very mundane, everyday kind of circumstances, conversations, television programs, movies, interactions between people, my work environment. It comes through all those things, what I'm normally walking through in my life, through the teachers at my school.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Absolutely.
All right. So can we go on?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll try one more verse. Again, we're in Ephesians 6, and so verse 13. Therefore, take up the full armor of God, that you may be able to resist in the evil day, having done everything to stand firm.
Yeah, he's just repeating what he said earlier about put on the full armor of God, that you might be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. And then he says in the verse before this, in 12, this is your real struggle, so therefore, having put on the armor, having clothed yourself with the truth that you need to clothe yourself with and identified yourself with that, you do that so that in that evil day you might be able to stand firm, having done what you need to do to equip yourself, essentially. So what does he mean by that evil day? I think by that evil day he means at whatever time the forces of evil attack, at whatever point there's trying to find that point of vulnerability in you to tell you the lie that you're going to believe. On that day, you'll be able to stand firm and not be driven off your ground.
So, Jack, why doesn't it say, so that I may be able to resist when the evil days come? It sounds like there's one evil day rather than a plurality of them.
Well, I think there are a plurality. I think he's just phrasing it this way because he's saying, in that evil day, whichever day we might be talking about, take up the full armor of God, make it a permanent fixture of your life so that whenever that evil day comes, you can resist it. I don't think he's implying that there is only one, only that it's some indefinite day, whichever one you want to talk about.
Okay, and I think there's an emphasis that is, you know, take up the full armor of God, do that today, prepare mm-hmm. yourself today.
Exactly.
So that tomorrow or the next day or a year from now when real difficult things come, actually, Jack, real difficult things come every day, but be prepared for the every day because they're going to come. And do everything that you possibly can. And in all that that you've done, hold on. Hold on tight.
Right, right.
Don't let go. Don't let the winds of desire push you around.
Right.
Look at what the truth is and keep looking at that. It never worked for me, but the image that just came to mind for me was I remember going to birthing classes before I had my first child, and they said what you need to do is you need to focus on something in the room and just kind of pick that out and pay attention to it. And then it's going to help you stand firm against the pain that comes. Well, I was never able to hardly see, much less stand firm. But I think that's kind of how life is we're supposed to pick something to look at, and that what we're supposed to look at is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the labor pains come, and they're so excruciating, squint, keep looking, pay attention. And the better prepared you are, the more you've looked at that, the better you'll be. And I remember an example, although the birthing class thing didn't work, I ended up doing some work with somebody who helped me with that more. It's kind of a hypnotic technique. And so I actually, for my third child, went to a hypnotherapist to help me do better what they taught you to do in the birthing classes. And this guy just kind of made more personal the object to pay attention to. And he brought in all my senses, and I picked the ones that were most strong to me. And so I had done the practice. I had looked at what was important to me. I had had a focus point that was actually ended up being something that I remembered, and it was an internal one. I practiced it. And so when the birth came along, I was able to have some strength to focus on that so that the pain didn't just take me away. I was standing firm on something else. Do you understand the image?
Yeah. And what you're saying is that's the analogy to what he's saying here, is to, if we keep our focus focused keenly and dramatically on the truth of what God wants for me and what he's going to accomplish for me and what he's going to give me, that can be the thing that carries me through the difficulty, the fiery darts and everything that Satan throws at me. Exactly.
But I have to do the work
of
understanding what that is. What is truth?
Right.
And that becomes a very difficult part of the process.
And by speaking of it in terms of armor that we're putting on, we are personalizing it. We're making an existential commitment to it. It's not some abstract intellectual theory that we're understanding. It's a personal commitment of our own being to the truth of the gospel.
Don't go away. Jack and Christine will continue the discussion in just a moment. You've heard it said that a college degree is not what it used to be. It seems these days colleges and universities are charging more and offering less. That's one of the reasons why Gutenberg College was developed. While many universities brag about their massive size and huge student body, Gutenberg College thrives on the idea that big is not always better. A student should not become a meaningless cog in some big education machine. A student should have the chance to interact in a meaningful way with his or her peers and professors. At Gutenberg, classes are small. Interaction with other students and with faculty is high. And education becomes interesting as well as rewarding. Imagine having a deep discussion about Aristotle or Shakespeare, where your ideas are sincerely considered. Imagine struggling to understand the writings of Augustine and having a faculty tutor come alongside you to help. And you'll get a good idea of why Gutenberg exists. And yet, there are many other advantages to Gutenberg other than its size. If you want to know more about Gutenberg College and all that it offers, call 541-485-4801. That's area code 541 485-4801. Now, if you didn't have time to write that down, stay tuned. We'll repeat it again at the end of the program. Here again are Jack and Christine.
Jack, I have been really amazed as I found out how much radio time costs. How about for you?
Yeah. What does it cost?
Well, just to be on 7 stations, and we don't really have great times. We have Saturday evenings. We have some midnight times. I guess some of the times are better than others. But even for times that are not premium, you know, the top of the line, we're spending $54,000 a year just to be on those stations.
Yeah.
Pretty incredible.
It is.
It is. Sometimes when I've heard radio stations or people asking for money, I've thought, come on, you guys, you're just trying to line your pockets. And that certainly isn't true here. I think just for us to maintain our opportunity to be on those channels, it really is a stretch.
Why don't you lay out the whole budget so people can compare the radio time versus the other expenditures?
Okay, so the radio time is approximately $54,000 a year. And that equals out to about $4,500 a month. So that's just being on the air. We have two other expenditures. One is personnel, and that's about $28,000 a year, which equals about $2,300 a month. So you can see that a much greater portion of our finances are going out actually to airtime than into paying for personnel. And then we have one other, you know, item that's kind of bulked into one, just kind of other expenditures, equipment, postage, supplies, stuff like that. And that's about $8,000 a year. So it's pretty minimal. We've got all our equipment pretty much purchased. I think we want another microphone that's better if we had our druthers. But other than that, I think we've got pretty much the equipment, and we don't have any expenditures for rent because I don't know if people know this, but why don't you explain where we meet?
We meet in a dungeon in your house.
Oh, we do, don't we? I never thought about it as a dungeon. Come on.
It's a little storage room surrounded by boxes and cement walls and file cabinets and insulation.
Exposed insulation and a couple of different kinds of light and boxes that are all out of order. But I think it really gives good acoustics.
Yeah, great acoustics.
It really is great. I mean, it was kind of a find. But we don't pay anything for this. So what we're doing is we're kind of like that companies, you know, that kind of start out in the back of a garage and we're just kind of scraping to make it work. And I think that's the picture that's pretty appropriate. I think I saw one of some big computer company recently that they started out. I think in a magazine they showed the back of a house or back of a garage, and that's really what we look like here. But anyway, our monthly expenses then for just these supplies and equipment are about $700 a month. So that's really the breakdown.
And unlike those computer companies, we never intend to be on Wall Street. We would just like to meet our expenses as they are right now.
Exactly.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403.
If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.